You're listening to Season 4 of the Queen's Memory Podcast. My name is Jiefei Yuan, and I'm the Queen's Memory Curator. This new season is called Memories of Water. It features stories about climate change in Queens and how affected communities are responding. Through interviews with local residents, community advocates, and climate experts, these episodes explore themes of belonging and resilience in the face of an unfolding crisis. In this second episode, Rebecca Seidel, a Rico Park native and audio producer, speaks with Queens teens about the questions they have when it comes to climate change, while reflecting on the importance of climate literacy on a local level.
Take a second here to just make sure we're all set up here.
Do you want to start asking the questions?
Yeah. Sorry.
Welcome to a special episode of the Queen's Memory Podcast. We're coming at you live from the Flushing branch of the Queen's Public Library.
I'm Adelina, and I go to Bayside High School.
I'm Joshua, and I go to Bayside High School.
I'm Anson Lee, and I go to Townsend Harris High School.
I'm Marcella Ramos, and I also go to Townsend Harris High School.
So if the red light means it's recording. So that was a practice, right?
Okay.
So let's try it again.
And I'm Rebecca Seidel. I went to Townsend Harris High School more than a decade ago, and I still live here in Queens. When I was in high school, I thought about climate change as this big, scary, global catastrophe that was inching closer to us. But I'll confess, it still felt like this faraway thing to me. I honestly didn't think much about how climate change would affect our city, let alone our borough. This was before Hurricane Sandy in 2012. Before Hurricane Ida in 2021, and way before footage of flash floods at subway stations swept the internet and became a viral meme. Nowadays, climate change feels like a much more present threat. But the truth is, parts of Queens have been prone to flooding for a long time. Flushing is one of the most flood-prone places of all, partly because of where it's located, and partly because of how it was developed. So after all these years, I wanted to better understand the history of flooding in this area and what local organizations are doing about it. So I teamed up with a group of teens here at the library to find out. You're going to be hearing their voices throughout this episode, along with mine, narrating and asking questions. We started with a place right down the block from the Flushing Library, a place where, side note, my friends and I took our high school prom pictures back in the day.
For the staff working at the Queens Botanical Garden, plants have special meaning.
Plants symbolize life to me.
I think also resistance, yeah. Too.
Those are our two guests for today's episode. They both work at the garden, which they call QBG for short.
My name is Natalie Pages. I'm the Family Engagement and Education Coordinator at QBG.
And I'm Katrina, I also go by Kat Downey. I am the Professional Learning Manager at Queens Botanical Garden.
QBG's mission is to be a place where people, plants, and cultures meet. And Kat says that you can see that happening as soon as you walk in.
Especially coming there in the mornings, there are so many people from the community doing dances and stretches and exercises. I think it's just a really cool way to start the day.
So how would you guys paint a picture of it? Like, how would you describe how it looks like inside?
Well, if you walk in through the main street entrance, you have these two huge blue Atlas cedars, which actually come from the World's Fair, which is how Queens Botanical Garden originated.
Queens Botanical Garden sits at the northeast corner of Flushing Meadows Corona Park. It actually evolved out of an exhibit at the 1939 World's Fair called Gardens on Parade. Natalie says that understanding the history of this park and the land it sits on is key to understanding why flooding is such a major issue here.
Historically, Queens was a wetland, so these are issues that are going to be constant for this space. Water naturally flows here.
It's true. Water literally shaped what Queens is today. Wetlands are an important type of ecosystem that can filter toxins from water and minimize the impacts of flooding and erosion. For a long time, the site of Flushing Meadows Corona Park was a constellation of wetlands and creeks. The Matinecock tribe were the first people to live on the land, living and hunting and fishing there for centuries. But then came European settlement and industrialization, and the landscape began to change dramatically. In the early 1900s, the Brooklyn Ash Removal Company got permission to dump ash from fireplaces and industrial projects into this area. And so the site became a landfill, a dumping ground for ash and waste from across the city. This infamous chapter will live on forever in F. Scott Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby, where this spot came to be called the Valley of Ashes. But this era came to an end when New York City Parks Commissioner Robert Moses proposed building a park there. It became the site of the 1939 World's Fair.
Gateway to the $155 million wonderland. From far and near come countless visitors. By every mode of travel.
To make the World's Fair happen, workers leveled out all that toxic ash. They also had to excavate and fill in parts of Flushing Creek to build what would become Flushing Meadows Corona Park. Today, out of what used to be at least 157 acres of tidal wetlands, only 21 acres remain. That's less than 15%. It's no wonder that when it rains, it floods. The water has nowhere to go.
If this keeps happening, how will it affect people in Queens?
I don't want to sound alarmist, but probably quite seriously. We already are seeing increased flooding and flash floods, so that's going to impact how people live, especially folks that are living in basement apartments will be at risk of being displaced.
So, what's the Queens Botanical Garden doing about this? To start, they're paying a lot of attention to their own landscape.
They've built a lot of infrastructure at the garden to absorb rainwater, including a cleansing biotope, which is an area filled with native wetland plants. The roots of the plants filter rainwater, and the water gets cycled through other parts of the garden. This way, excess rain gets put to use.
Kat and Natalie also want to educate the community, all of us, about what we can do to help fight climate change at home. This spring, they taught a course to middle school teachers across New York City as part of the city's Urban Advantage program. Their goal was to help the teachers improve how they taught science in their classrooms through a local lens.
So we'll be working with about 25 teachers on that one to explore a little bit the history of Flushing, try and understand why flooding is such a serious issue here.
One rainy Sunday, we joined the class for a field trip, walking from the Botanical Garden and through Flushing Meadows Corona Park. Along the way, Kat encouraged the teachers to observe their surroundings, especially the trees. They wrote down their observations in folded up paper zines.
Okay, so now also I want us to keep an eye out for our tree senses. So I would get out your zine over here and start making tally marks.
As we see trees
with your partner, maybe have some.
Right from the start, Kat and her colleagues pointed out features of the Botanical Garden's landscape that were built with flooding in mind.
Also, you can see beneath their feet, all of this, including the parking garden pavement, is permeable, so to avoid flooding as best as possible. Also, these two areas they just pointed out are made to flood, so maybe when we come back, we'll be able to see a pond starting to form out here. And if it gets really bad, we'll see a pond over here as well.
We kept on walking, pulling out umbrellas as the rain picked up. And then, standing on the sidewalk right outside QBG, we stopped.
Can I have a show of hands if anyone has seen one of these in their neighborhoods or before? One, two, three. Rosalind, can you share with us what it is?
It's a rain garden!
It's a rain garden, yeah. Have any of you heard the term rain garden before? Yes.
This rain garden was honestly pretty nondescript looking. A rectangular patch of soil and plants set into the sidewalk, jutting out a bit into the curb. If you live in New York City, chances are you've seen one of these. There are more than 11,000 rain gardens across the five boroughs. And it turns out, there's more to them than meets the eye. To get a better understanding of this, my colleagues at Queens Memory spoke with members of the Newtown Creek Alliance. It's an organization that's protecting the area around Newtown Creek, an offshoot of the East River on the Brooklyn-Queens border. They support green infrastructure in the area, including a network of rain gardens.
So this is one of the rain gardens that we take care of in front of a school.
That's Brenda Suchilt, Newtown Creek Alliance's horticulturist. While walking along the streets of Sunnyside, she explained how rain gardens receive and process stormwater. It turns out, rain gardens have a lot of layers.
At the very bottom of each of the rain gardens, after the layer of the engineered soil, which is mostly made out of sand, there's a layer of rocks after that that filters some of that stormwater runoff as well. Once it's gone through the plants, once it's gone through the soil, and then it's attached to a catch basin.
All of this helps prevent too much stormwater from going into our sewer system, which already has to deal with all of our wastewater on top of excess rain.
So whenever you're flushing your toilets, whenever you're taking a shower, whenever you're doing your laundry, all of that sewage essentially gets taken straight into the same drain that is used for stormwater.
One rain garden alone can absorb 2,500 gallons of water a day. This is extremely helpful for places like Flushing waterways, where only 0.1 inch of rain overwhelms the sewer system. So on our rainy walk that day from Queens Botanical Garden to Flushing Meadows, that rain garden we stopped at was doing a lot below the surface.
I ran a race here last fall, and it was pouring. It was like cold and rainy.
I'd walked and run through Flushing Meadows Corona Park 1,000 times before. I have noticed how this park floods pretty badly in the rain. And now I know why. And I realized something else. Learning the history of flooding in Queens is one thing, but actually solving it, that's going to involve passing our knowledge down to the next generation. Whether we're maintaining rain gardens together or testing the local water quality.
So can you describe what you're doing?
Yeah, so there's a string that you hold onto, and then there is this net. I have a DIY one.
We're standing at the edge of the park's huge semicircle-shaped pond, known in the World's Fair days as the Pool of Industry. This pool of water is actually part of Flushing Creek, a waterway that mostly remains hidden underground today. Kat is about to show the teachers how to collect a water sample from the pond using a kind of DIY fishing mechanism.
And we're gonna get it wet so that it gets some weight to it and chuck it out as far as we can. And what you wanna do is try to get some sort of flow or stream into it.
The teachers collected several bottles of water from the pond. The water was dark brown and sludgy. Kat explained that we were going to look at the water under a microscope back in the classroom and talk about the different kinds of organisms that were swimming in there. I thought back to my own middle and high school experience here in Queens. I couldn't remember doing anything quite this hands-on when it came to learning about our local climate. I think it would have stuck with me, or at least taught me to pay closer attention. I could see this happening in real time with the teens at the library as they interviewed the staffers from QBG. The teens asked some really thoughtful questions about what they can do to help fight flooding at home.
I'm currently taking an AP environmental class. So how would you connect to the youth and help build like environmental issues and put that into public schools?
Sure. A lot of schools that I've worked with often have green teams. So if you're able to get connected with those, I feel like that's a great first step. If not, looking into your community and seeing if there are any like gardens or organizations that you can maybe volunteer with or get connected with. That's usually a good place to start and get to meet people as well that might be able to connect you with opportunities.
I could see the teens lean in and pay closer attention as they learned about practical everyday solutions to address flooding in their neighborhood. Which brought me back to something that Brenda from the Newtown Creek Alliance said about using rain gardens as an educational tool.
If there was just the proper resources and funding for like schools to have a little bit more involvement with their own education, you know, like a middle school could take care of a couple rain gardens in their area and understand, and that could even be a part of their education of like designing a rain garden or something. You know, it could still be very play-based, you know, but in a perfect world, I guess.
The dangers of flooding have become starkly clear in recent years. During Hurricane Ida in 2021, three people died in a flooded basement apartment in Flushing. We're going to dig into that in our next episode. But this isn't just happening in coastal cities. The historic flooding in Texas this summer and the hurricanes that hit North Carolina last fall, these have all been deadly wake-up calls for what's to come. As climate change continues to intensify weather events and increase the risk of flooding. At the Queen's Botanical Garden, Kat says that looking to the past helps her find hope.
Flushing Meadows Corona Park and the land that QBG is on now used to be an ash landfill. Like, it was literally a wasteland. Like, it was only a space to put stuff that wasn't of use anymore. And for it to now be a center for people to come and spend their mornings and to grow their food, I think is a really important, not only symbol because it's real, like it's a real thing, but of hope of what can be.
Understanding how far we've come also plants the seeds for envisioning a better future.
Practicing like radical imagination is really important because if you have no idea what environmental justice looks like, then you can't do environmental justice. And it's only through either in classes or meeting with people that you're able to imagine what the world you want to look like is and then work towards it.
Thanks for sitting down with us today, and we really enjoyed your stories. And
thank you so much. Yeah,
thank you guys. That was awesome.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Queen's Memory Podcast. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
I sound like an AI.
You sound like an AI.
This podcast is brought to you by the Queen's Memory Project. This episode was developed in partnership with the Queen's Public Library's Teen Services Team as part of a 6-week-long audio storytelling workshop held at the Flushing Library. For full transcripts and show notes from this episode, please visit queenslib.org/QM podcast. You can also find us on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcast by searching Queen's Memory Podcast. This episode was produced by Rebecca Seidel in conjunction with Jiefei Yuan and Meryl Agish. Mixing and editing by Rebecca Seidel with music composed by Elias Raven. Additional music in this episode by Blue Dot Sessions. Special thanks to Jordan Gasparet, the Queen's Botanical Garden, Newtown Creek Alliance, and the Flushing Library Teen Center. Queen's Memory is an ongoing community-centered archiving program by the Queen's Public Library and Queen's College CUNY. The views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in this episode are those of its creators and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of Queens Public Library, the City University of New York, or their employees. Thanks for listening.